This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in this afternoon. I'm Bonnie North. Many of us cook every day, and we probably don't think too much about it. The once translucent egg white turns white, or the bright red steak turns brown, and we just accept that that's what food does. But humans are perhaps the only animal that actually cooks its food. Some scientists believe our ability to manipulate foodstuffs has had a profound effect on our evolution. And the science behind cooked food may be just as profound, as Professor Paul Lyman can tell you. Lyman is currently the featured speaker for UW-Milwaukee's Science Bag series. His presentation is aptly titled, Cooked, Science in the Kitchen. He sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about some of the many questions that he answers in his talk.
How does the structure change? Why does the texture of food change when you cook it? I do an example of an egg. A raw egg is this, you know, runny mass of white stuff, and then you cook it just a few minutes, and it turns into this solid that's no longer transparent. How did that change with just a little bit of temperature? Why does raw meat, it doesn't really appeal to us too much, but put it on a barbecue for a while, and I want to eat it.
It is interesting because we're one of the only animals that actually cooks our food. And, you know, as you mentioned, a raw egg does not hold a lot of appeal. Eggs themselves are pretty fascinating.
Oh, they are.
The white part especially, you know, you just talked about this, but it goes from being this kind of translucent, kind of soggy mess into a hard, opaque substance.
Yes.
How does that happen?
Well, it's mostly water in the egg white, but there's about 10% of it are proteins. Proteins are kind of long chains of certain kind of molecules called amino acids. Amino acids are sort of like the Legos of biochemistry. String them together and you form a long protein. Proteins are interesting because they have a long chain that's very strong along the chain, but then it folds up upon itself in ways that's dictated by that sequence of amino acids. Anyway, in the egg, proteins are coiled up into these little bundles, and they're so small when they're bundled up like that that they don't scatter light. That is, the egg is still transparent. And just a little bit of cooking, those little coils of proteins uncoil and they stretch out like filaments, and then there's enough of them that they bond to each other and make a kind of a network out of these adjacent uncoiled proteins. That net captures the water and so basically makes water droplets dispersed within this protein network. That's what gives it its firmness.
So the proteins, essentially, they're these little guys that are all coiled up. And when you add heat, they're like, oh, I'm going to stretch out. I gotta lounge out.
Yeah, that's right. But you can never put the genie back in the bottle. You can never coil those proteins back up.
You can't uncook an egg.
You can't uncook an egg.
So when we're looking at an egg, we obviously have the white portion, the kind of protein around another little package of protein. But they're very different. And, you know, anybody who's separated an egg can tell you it's not that difficult to take the yolk out of the white. These are two very different substances.
That's right. They are. I mean, they're both largely protein and water. The yolk, it's about half fat and protein and half water, whereas the white is like 90% water. Most of the action for the developing embryo would be in the yolk, and the yolk is basically food for the developing embryo. The white is eventually food for the developing embryo, but mostly it's packaging. Mostly it's cushioning, protection. So most of the action comes from the yellow.
So yolks are part of a process that occurs in a lot of different types of food. Emulsion. How does that work?
Yes, emulsions, it's putting one substance into another that don't normally mix. So oil and water would be the classic example. If anybody's ever tried to mix oil and water, you know that they separate. An emulsion is you get tiny little drops of, say, oil spread throughout the water. Normally, it would just separate out, but there's ways to stabilize that little droplet called an emulsifier. The most common example is soap. You have oil on your hands. You go and run that under a sink. You know, you still have oily hands. But if you put some soap on it, what you're doing is creating these small structures called micelles. That's a big word. Let me back that up. what is soap? It is a molecule that looks like water on one end of it and looks like fat or oil on the other end of it. And so if you put a number of these soap molecules into water, what they do is they form these little almost shell-like structures called micelles. And so the oily parts hang out with the oily parts and the water parts hang out with the water parts in this little shell. Well, an oil droplet can fit inside there. And so that's a way of dispersing oil within water. So that's what happens when you wash your hands, but that's also what happens if you make mayonnaise.
Yeah, anybody who has seen mayonnaise made, it's eggs and then it's oil. And they both start as this kind of semi-translucent substance. And then as you mix them together, they become this very thick white mayonnaise.
You know how you could have ice and it's perfectly clear? Snow is the same thing, but it's opaque. Why is that? It has to do with that you have a mixture of two things. In snow, you have air and water, ice. The ice of a snowflake is clear, but then the light goes through air and then through ice and then through air and then through ice, and it's that change from one substance to the other that causes the light to be deflected in different directions. So now if you imagine trying to shine a flashlight through a bunch of snow, it gets deflected a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, and eventually it doesn't come out at all. It scatters back, and that's what we perceive as white. Same thing happens in mayonnaise. It's these little globs of fat, little globs of water, and the light gets deflected a little to the left, a little to the right, and your mayonnaise looks white.
What are some other common examples of emulsions that, you know, we might be either drinking or eating on a daily basis?
Well, salad dressing is a pretty good example. So again, it's oil and vinegar. And if you try and mix them up at the restaurant, they separate. But we put some emulsifiers in them to stabilize it. Egg yolk is a very good example of one. And that's where you get Caesar salad dressing from. But it's very fortunate that there are some other emulsifiers which happen to be delicious. So garlic and mustard both happen to have very good emulsification properties. That is, they have molecules that are kind of like soap, except they're tasty. You put some mustard in your oil and vinegar and shake it up, and it's more stable.
Another emulsion that I didn't realize was an emulsion is milk. That's something that you talk about in your presentation.
That's right. So a growing baby needs all kinds of nutrients, right? And so you need protein, you need fat, you need water. So how did we evolve to deliver all those in one substance? Well, it's done again through an emulsion. Milk is mostly water, but there's a lot of protein, 10% protein and 4% fat. And those fat globules are dispersed through the milk. Proteins in there and a couple of varieties. There's casein, and then there's other proteins which are called whey proteins.
Well, and these are all terms that come up in the cheesemaking process. As you mentioned, casein is something that's inside of milk just in general, and whey is something that's inside of milk. And when you get into the cheesemaking process, these are things that seem to kind of separate. How does that happen?
That's right. So an emulsion is when you get these things mixed together, but as a cook, you may have come across a time when you break an emulsion, and that means it separates into the two component parts. So if you were to shake up oil and vinegar, you make temporarily an emulsion, but it will break. It'll separate into two parts. Well, making cheese is breaking that emulsion. It's a complicated process for cheese. There's these little structures of casein proteins, and they all carry a negative electrical charge. That's important because they repel one another. So these substances would ordinarily like to be together because they're chemically similar, but they have this electrical charge that keeps them separated. In the stomach of a calf, there's a substance called rennet. It's an enzyme, and that's just another fancy word that means something that helps a chemical reaction to happen. In this case, it goes in and it clips off the protein off the casein cluster that carries that negative charge. And it does it very efficiently, very fast. The result is that all these formerly negatively charged caseins are now neutral. And now they like to bond to each other. And so they bond to each other and form a network. It's almost like making a fishing net. And they capture all the things that are not water, all the fats and other proteins. The result is that the milk breaks up into cheese curds. I'm sure you've heard of cheese curds. So this is where it comes from. Breaks up into cheese curds on one hand and liquid whey, basically the water and some of the sugars and some of the proteins, separate out into the other phase. And so you used to have homogeneous milk, and now you have clumps of white semi-solids and almost clear liquid.
Is it appropriate to say that the rennet partially digests parts of that milk in order to separate it?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to say it. It certainly aids in the digestion as far as the calf is concerned.
So when it does that, we have what we may commonly call whey, and then we have curds. And a lot of the time, these curds are going to be just that kind of soft cheese that we eat right away. How do we get from something that is a curd and a soft kind of cheese into the harder cheeses like a cheddar or a Swiss?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So as you point out, yes, all cheese kind of starts out in that way of making these soft cheese curds. But then the cheesemaker can go all kinds of different directions. You can leave them more or less in that soft form and cook them a little bit and make a stringy cheese, mozzarella. Or you can take those curds and put them into a mold and drain yet more and more of the liquid out, more and more of the water out. And you can add substances to make it more tasty. Salt. All the cheeses are salted pretty much. But then a lot of the heavy lifting is done by bacteria or yeast. Blue cheese, for instance, has I suppose it's a mold, and it modifies the cheese curds and creates these various aroma compounds and flavor compounds, some of which we find delicious, some of which we don't. Some of these are acquired tastes. Also, there's changes that just happen over time due to the substances within the cheese itself, like the rennet, continues to alter the fats and proteins within the cheese.
And there's one reaction in particular that a lot of people credit as being the thing that makes food delicious, and it's called the Maillard reaction.
Yeah, Maillard reaction.
Maillard reaction.
And again, I personally say Maillard. Probably a French-speaking person would probably be cringing. But earlier when I was talking about cooking eggs, I talked about the proteins uncoiling. But the proteins were not damaged in that process. That is, the chain was not broken. In the Maillard reaction, the chain is broken. So we have a protein which is, again, made up of these things called amino acids. And if you have sugar around, the sugar and the protein molecule reacts and basically makes a chemical reaction that breaks the protein into smaller pieces. It makes them into hundreds of smaller pieces. But for whatever reason, the compounds it gives off are delicious smelling. They're smaller, and so they can become vaporized, that is, you can smell them. And so these little bits come off, and they're very flavorful. This is what you smell when you smell baking bread. This is what you smell when you smell roasting coffee. This is what you smell when you barbecue meat. So Maillard reactions are browning reactions. You know, all the things I just mentioned turns out to be that the substance turns brown. There are other browning reactions, but focusing on these ones where the proteins are broken and they create volatile, delicious smelling compounds that we all know from cooking.
So something that undergoes the Maillard reaction in order to become, you know, what we find delicious, but also has a lot of other stuff going on inside is bread. There's a lot of conversation about gluten, especially because a lot of people have different issues with gluten. But the structures are really fascinating. What's happening when bread is being first kind of mixed together?
Yeah. So when you grind wheat, there are small segments of a protein called glutilin and glutenin. Collectively, we'll just call them glutens. They're chains of proteins that are a certain length. But what's interesting is they're like Legos. When they're exposed to water and oxygen, they link together at the ends very quickly. They react together. And so what used to be a moderately long molecule becomes an extremely long molecule. They're also kind of elastic, kind of stretchy, because before and after they're linked up, there's coils and kinks along the length of this chain. So I would say think of a slinky. they're coiled up. But then once we add water and oxygen, they bind together. So it's like you took three Slinkies and made them longer and then longer and longer and longer. Now, as you're kneading the dough, what you're doing is stretching out those chains of gluten. And then you know how dough then kind of retracts after you knead it. What's going on there is those coils and kinks are retracting, just like a Slinky would. So if you keep working at this, what you do is you're cross-linking all of these different filaments of gluten. Again, if you had a whole bunch of Slinkies and you were put them in a washing machine or something, you know, it would be a tangled mess. Well, that's what you're doing when you knead bread. You're making this tangled mess. If you continue to knead it, it actually develops into sheets of gluten. These gluten sheets are what trap the bubbles of steam when you bake bread, and that's what allows bread to rise. Otherwise, if the gas just went out, the bread wouldn't rise. Think about when you make pancakes. There, you have not developed a gluten network, and so those bubbles that come to the surface, they get away, and your pancake doesn't rise very much.
Which is what you kind of want from a pancake.
That's what you want from a pancake. So there are times that you want this gluten network. If you like, want a nice crusty piece of bread or a nice roll that you can sink your teeth in, you want it to be tough and to have some resistance and to puff up when you bake it.
Well, and that gets to the idea of kneading and over-kneading. And that's something I know bakers have to deal with all of the time. It really depends on what you're making, how much you need to knead it. And I know that there's a structural difference that you talk about between something like bread or something like a pastry, the kinds of desserts that we eat.
That's right. Sometimes you want it to be crumbly and flaky. And what you need to do then is to not allow that gluten network to form so well. The way to do that is to control the reaction of linking those gluten molecules up by introducing a fat. So before you add the water, you put fat, often butter, in. If you've baked a pie, you've cut butter into flour. What that butter is doing is changing the gluten so that it can't react into these long filaments. The other thing it does is it kind of binds to the outside of the filament. So even if you do have a filament, it can't bind to the next gluten molecule. So it becomes more tender, friable. In fact, this is just a coincidence, but we say we add shortening. What you're doing when you have shortening is you're shortening the length of the gluten molecules.
Professor Lyman, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Paul Lyman is a physics professor at UW-Milwaukee. He's the featured speaker for this month's Science Bag series. Lyman spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about his presentation entitled Cooked: Science in the Kitchen. You can go to wuwm.com to find dates and times for Lyman's next presentation.